Welcome back, everybody, for another episode of Let's Go Steal a Podcast. This episode was supposed to go up last week, but I was recovering from vacation and I didn't want to record. So here we are today.
Well, and it was just as well because I was sicker than a dog.
See? The planets aligned. I didn't even like message you because I was like, I'm still getting over being off for a week. Not that I did anything strenuous at all, but you know, going back to work, that's hard. So Sally Kilpatrick is back with me.
Hello, I'm hello.
Excited. I really love this episode of Leverage.
I do too. I thought it was very well crafted from a,
yeah,
like from a storytelling perspective.
Yeah, it's beautifully written. It's really tight. There are like no like loose ends. And it also like, it has a little, like a personal background for me. So we're going to get into that. Ooh. Today we're going to be talking about The Underground Job, which aired on August 15th, 2010, which we're ahead of the schedule now. The last episode we talked about was on the day that it came out.
Wow.
Our podcast came out, which is really exciting. And
I do remember watching this one, I believe, with it actually aired.
Whoa, with commercials and everything?
With commercials.
Wow. Takes me back. Commercials you have to sit through. I hate it now when I watch live television. I'm like, what? I can't fast forward. I have to watch the same Macy's commercial 18 times in one
pizza hut.
Awful. So The Underground Job was directed by Mark Roskin, who is the series regular. He directed The Stork Job, The Tap Out Job, 3 Days of the Hunter Job, Runway Job, and so on and so forth. And it was written by, as John Rogers calls them, the Wonder Twins, Melissa Glenn and Jessica Reeder, who's now Jessica Grassel. So in this episode, after a fatal explosion at a mine, Nate and the crew travel to coal country to take down a mine owner who ignores safety protocols and the corrupt attorney general who helps him in return for political funds. This episode was inspired by a real coal mine accident that happened in early 2010, the Upper Big Branch mine disaster in West Virginia. And I'll put a link to just you can look into it more, but I'll put a link to the Wikipedia article in the show notes. In that disaster, 12 people died as well, just like in this one. For the same reasons, there was an excess of methane gas, which is highly flammable, and it caught fire and it exploded. And I don't remember this happening.
I vaguely remember this. And I kind of glanced at it today too, just to kind of look at the original incidents. And I want to say that the whole part about taking government money, but not actually repairing the safety problems was part of the real incident as well.
And yeah, this
story.
Ugh. It's disgusting. And I can't remember if, I guess it happened before the accident. So it wasn't like, hopefully it didn't continue to happen after the accident, but it was the reason that the safety protocols weren't in place and the accident happened. Ugh. Just awful. Yeah. So let's start with this episode. Okay. We're going to start in this lovely green wooded area because Portland, I feel, really doubles for West Virginia pretty well.
I thought it looked pretty, I mean, when they said it was in Portland or wherever it is, Oregon, that it was filmed, it did remind me of driving, I want to say specifically like in the Harper's Ferry kind of area, or the part of West Virginia we drove through to get to Harper's Ferry back mm-hmm. a bajillion years ago. Very lush, very verdant, very green. That's what I remember.
But don't yeah. my best friend Holly just moved from West Virginia, and when I would go visit I would usually go visit in the winter, so it wasn't as like lush and green mm-hmm. as it is now or in this, but it was very hilly, which freaks me out coming from a very flat area of Texas, which is most of Texas. I was just like, are these always here, these giant yeah. mountainy things? I felt a little hemmed in, but this place where they're filming was actually a rock quarry, and they let them just dig a hole in the side of this hill and like put up the doorway. So it's not an actual mine, obviously, but they faked it. And it goes, they said that the doorway kind of goes in about 20 feet. So all those men were just, I guess, walked into this tunnel and then had to stand in the back in the shadows.
I guess that's why it was always shift change, so people could come and go. That's what was going on. Here, Bill, hand me your hat. I need to walk out now.
Exactly. And because it was a working rock quarry, they already had all of the big construction equipment, like all the the big
scooper thingies.
Scoopers, thank you. All of the equipment that they were just driving around.
That's a heavy term. Machinery. Let's just say that.
all of the words for those vehicles have gone right. Front loaders and I should know more of them.
I don't. It just bulldozers. The
prevalence of those things in children's literature, I should know more of them. But I don't. I don't. And we see as the shift changes to two guys, one who's coming out of the shift and one who's about to go in, stop, and they chat, and they mention the important piece of information that the methane levels were high in the mine, and then they stand there and chat a little bit, and it's really
about a birthday party.
Yeah, like, oh, come to my kid's birthday party. And then you because you've watched enough television, read enough things in life to know that if someone brings that up, mm-hmm. they're dying in the next couple minutes of this scene.
And the dialogue, and something's about to happen.
Yeah. It's awful because they're so sweet. They're like, he's like, do you want my wife to make her potato salad? And he says, that's the only reason you're invited. And then the boss drives up and tells them he doesn't pay them to lollygag. And I don't think he should get to use a word that fun because he's a dick.
I really don't.
Yeah.
Especially he shouldn't have a Cadillac that's kind of really more of a truck.
Yeah.
He should just go in and have a Boss Hog Cadillac with the horns on the front of it and just be a full-on villain.
Yeah, just lean into it, dude. Lean in. So, they go back in their separate directions, and just as Troy, I think is his name, is getting to his truck, the ground starts to shake Jurassic Park style, and then the mine explodes. It's awful. And all of the workers who are just coming off their long shift, like, just immediately turn around and run straight towards the fire.
I think that was one of the moments. So here's this boss man. He's like, call my lawyer. Meanwhile, all the men are running into the fire. And it's just like juxtaposition between that greedy SOB and all these other people. Sharp relief.
Yeah, it's horrible. He just stands there. I was like typing up my notes, and it was before I had finished rewatching the scene. I thought that I remembered that he just like walks back into his office and closes the door, and he's not quite that callous. He does watch it burn instead of leaving. But still, yeah, call my lawyer. Like, to have no heart. I can't imagine. So gross. And then we have a flash forward for 2 years. Mm-hmm. And Troy, who is the surviving miner from the first scene, is meeting with Nate and Elliot. But before we get into this, which is a really sad but a very important scene, I wanted to talk about the actor who plays Troy Owens. His name is Tim Whitcomb, and he is maybe the most fascinating man I've ever read about on IMDb. So he's from Milwaukee, and his parents opened the first bar in Green Bay to welcome Black patrons in the late 60s and early 70s.
Wow.
Yeah, it was called My Brother's Place, and they got a lot of hate and death threats, but he's like, but you know what? I was pretty fortunate. I got to meet a lot of the Green Bay Packers.
Did he get to meet Mean Joe Green, or was that later?
It says he met Herb Adderley and Willie Wood, who became close friends with the family. But wait, there's more about Timothy Whitcomb. He went to school in Green Bay, but he used to vacation in the summers in Eagle River, Wisconsin. And he fell in love with filmmaking when he got to watch the filming of Omen 2.
Oh, that and, seems like a cinematic classic.
Yes. And he became fascinated with movie magic when he vividly remembers watching the filming of The Woman Whose Eyes Get Plucked Out. So he watched this footage of a trained crow remove prosthetic eyes from, I guess, a dummy or something to get at the food.
I hope it was a dummy.
I know, right? It was a dummy. And he was, gosh. I know, what a talented actress if it wasn't. And he was grossed out, but also inspired. And then he started making home movies. And there's like lots of other stuff. Worked on Wall Street. And then he left that to become a producer. So he produced a movie called Anoush of the Airways, and which was one of the 8 finalists for the 1999 Hollywood Film Festival. But it got mixed reviews and only got foreign distribution, but it became a cult hit in Eastern European countries.
Did it have a crow plucking eyeballs?
It did not, but wait, there's more.
Oh my gosh. Are you going to send me a set of steak knives in a minute if I order now?
Yes, for, 10 easy payments in 1999. It says he's most proud of the viral hoax sensation Black Star Warrior HD, which was screened as lost footage at the 2010 Comic-Con in San Diego. Media picked it up, and a lot of people thought it was a true origin story for Lando Calrissian.
Oh, and
so I went and watched it. It's on YouTube. I'll also post a link to this in the show notes. It is like a preview for a lost Lando Calrissian prequel, but it's told in the story of like a blaxploitation film.
Lando Calrissian is like Shaft.
Yes. Yes. And I want to be upfront. Tim Whitcomb is a white man, but he didn't like write it or direct it or anything. He was a producer on it, but he's very proud of it. It is so good. It's so cheesy. Yeah.
I will have to check this out.
Yes. Tim Whitcomb playing Troy Owens.
He has layers.
I know. And this is just a little minor part, but yeah. All right. Renaissance man. Back to McRory's. Troy tells them that 12 men, well, he doesn't say men. He says 12, I had 12 brothers die in the explosion, because that's how close all of these coal miners are to each other. And like we said earlier, it was due to this buildup of methane, which is very flammable and which couldn't be vented because there's improper ventilation down in the mines. And I think this one's really important. Most people aren't in it just for the money when they come to Nate. They want some sort of revenge, or they want justice. The money is nice.
Justice.
Yeah, but like 100% of the time they want justice and maybe their own money back. But he doesn't want a payout for what went wrong. He wants to keep working in the mine. He doesn't want to be rich. He just wants to have a safe work environment for him and his brothers in the mine.
Which is reasonable.
Yeah, completely. And after the explosion, we find out that the mine received government money in order to make it safer, but none of it made it into the actual mine. And now it's just as bad, if not worse. So like every day they go to work, they're in danger of another explosion, of more people dying. And this is the main source of income for this entire little town in West Virginia. So they lose, 12 more incomes, or if the mine goes down, then this town is ruined. It's a lot of responsibility. And Nate tells them that they're going to find the money and they're going to put it where it belongs. Ooh, which is good. So Hardison does his, he runs the show, and he tells him that Blackwell, the owner, who I remember most notably from the first X-Men movie. He's the senator who hates mutants. Gets turned into a mutant.
Things happen.
Yeah.
Apparently he likes to play bad guys.
Yeah, he's really good at it. I wonder.
Good at it.
I wonder if, yeah. I didn't care enough about him to go into his IMDb. I'm sorry. I'm sure he's a very nice man in real life. But I was more intrigued with Tim Whitcomb.
Well, as it turns out, your curiosity was well-founded.
And so we find out that Blackwell, the owner, did use the money that he got from the government for a safety measure, one in particular. And her name is Deborah Pierce. She's the West Virginia Attorney General. According to Parker, her hair is very poofy.
It is. It's a thing. Yeah, I'm with Parker.
It is. Well, I mean, it's not true in this case, but they say the higher the hair, the closer to God.
That is not working for this woman, no.
It really is not.
No, no. I could not help but think that she had to have been inspired by Sarah Palin.
Yeah.
Hairstyle, the cut of the suits, yeah. The folksy manner. Because at one point she said, well, color me pink and put me in a pig pen, something like that. I'm like, well, that's new for me, and I'm from the country.
Right? And then when she talks about the rule of law is like a sewer.
Oh, my gosh. She went into this extended metaphor about sewers, and I was like, I am not squeamish, but you can end this metaphor
anytime. She like continued it later, too. I feel like she brought it up again.
Make sure the young is going in the right direction. What is your damage, woman?
So gross. So gross. Hardison tells us about a recent Supreme Court decision that removes limits of campaign donations to political action committees or PACs. So Blackwell has taken all of his government money and he has donated it to Pierce's PAC in exchange for her help. So since he's
making those 400 citations kind of disappear or be stalled out in appeals court.
Yeah. 400 citations in 2 years, 400. And they all get, yeah, like you said, they get held up in appeals so he doesn't have to pay anything while they're being appealed. And he's going to do that indefinitely. Oh my God. It's infuriating. And Elliot is grumpy and rightly so. And he says that they can't go after someone with an attorney general in their back pocket. And Nate agrees, but he's like, so that means we have to take both of them down.
I was like, okay.
So they're going to get Blackwell. They're going to get Blackwell to give them money from the PAC. And then once it's moved, they can flag them for misuse of campaign funds. If only the world worked that way.
I know.
So they're going to use the Skagway Shuffle to do this. And I love
our partisans. Y'all are making this up.
We're just making it up at this point. Which, the Skagway Shuffle is apparently a lot like the fiddle game, only underground, of course.
Well, and then Parker, can I be the fiddle? Well, yeah. I think it was Elliot the fiddle this time. Can I be the fiddle?
So he's like, no, the mine is the fiddle. They're going to convince him there's something valuable in his mine. Then they tell him that they have the way to process it and take all his money. So they are going to sell him his own mine. So they're not stealing anything this time.
Oh.
There's no let's go steal A. It's
right.
This.
I don't even know what to do with myself with this new information.
Right? It's like the rug has been ripped out from under us. So Elliot gets to go. Everybody goes undercover in this episode. Everybody. Mm-hmm. Elliot goes down into the mine with Troy, who has this young guy named Corey take him over to Section C, where he's going to be out of the way and he can get things sort of set up. And Corey is not happy about this duty that he's been given. He just looks a little put out. And the section where they're working, Troy warns him, has been abandoned for a while and the beam supports aren't great, so they need to be really careful. And then Sophie and Hardison storm into the office of Blackwell as mine safety coalition inspectors, and they need to go look around and take some readings. So Clark, the mine supervisor, takes them out into the mines, and like literally the door's not even closed all the way. Nate walks in, reprising his role as Bob Gibson, who he was in The Two Horse Job, which was Glenn and Reader's first episode.
Complete with bow tie.
yes, can be with both sides. But I feel like he's playing a different Bob Gibson.
He did. Yeah. Yeah.
He was like a raging dick in Two Horse Job. And here he's.
Unfortunately, we didn't have the accent of the Jimmy Papadopoulos.
I know. Like, or Jimmy Papadopoulos' suits. Jimmy Papadopoulos. Hopefully we'll see him again soon. But yeah, so Bob Gibson shows up and he tries to buy the mine. And Black almost
Blackwell's like, it's not for sale.
Yeah, no, it's my mine. Parker, meanwhile, is on her own undercover grifting situation. She's at the state capitol building, and she has to grift the attorney general. And we get, this episode is just packed full of informative flashbacks that I really love. Oh, yes. Especially this one of Sophie giving her a tutorial on, you know, she's like, oh, it's like wooing someone. And Parker's like, I don't woo.
Grift is like a romance. You have to woo them. And then Parker, I don't woo.
Parker's like, what romance? No.
And then Sophie has to say, okay, so what would you do if you were going to break into a bank? And Parker's like, goes through this whole list, like really quickly, of the security system and then disable the camera and do this and do that and do that. And Sophie's like, do that to people.
That's all you got to do. Look at them like a bank. I love that Sophie says, here, take notes, and she hands her a notepad, and then Parker takes her literally throughout the entire episode, and so she's just taking notes the whole time, as if Parker doesn't have almost
a photographic memory.
Right?
Yeah.
You know, we saw in the last episode, she was just like, you know, spouting off all of the stats for all the area banks. Like, there were like 10 of them, and she was like, oh, this, and like just telling you everything about the security systems of each one. Like, she can remember the stuff, but she's like, I'm going to keep track of all this stuff. And I love at the end, she's like, and then you can steal her. She's like, soul. So he's like,
I was going to say mine.
I was going to say confidence, but okay. Sure. But then immediately she's so good at this grift.
Well, there was that moment where she was hesitating earlier, and I'm like, this is the woman who like just jumps off buildings and goes down mine shafts, but she's like, I don't want to go deal with this person. And really, once you meet the person, you're kind of like, let's see where she was coming from.
I know, right? I mean, I don't, yeah. Mm-mm. And that's very different, like a physical danger and then like a talking to another human being.
Mm-hmm. I related. I'm getting more introverted as I get older.
Right. it's bad. The world is horrible. So we meet Pierce and she's giving a speech to her mirror, which I think is just a really cool directorial cinematographical thing where you see her and then you realize you're seeing her reflection as it pans away. And Parker plants a bug on her desk as she's explaining that she doesn't need to be paid to work for her. She would pay for the honor, actually.
Such McLaughlins. And I'm like, oh my gosh.
Don't you know who my family is? We're rich. And just like that, she's hired. That's all it takes. Being rich. Elliot and the kid Corey are down in the mine and they're doing busy work, as Corey complains later. And what they're doing, they kind of explain it a little later, but they're putting limestone on the walls of the tunnel. And I looked up a little bit about that. So it says, milled limestone, referred to as rock dust by the coal industry, is an additive used for safety in underground bituminous coal mines.
Yes.
The particles of the milled limestone mix with coal dust to prevent a potential explosion. Rock dust. So this is where this kind of falls down, because rock dust is blown or sprayed as a slurry onto the roof, ribs, and floor of the mine and needs to be applied on a regular basis to maintain its effectiveness. And here they just have little bags of it and they're just sprinkling it on by hand, which even just watching it as a layperson, I was like, well, that doesn't seem very efficient.
No, but if they'd been using some kind of blower, we couldn't have heard their conversation.
That's true. Well, that, we wouldn't be able to do the thing that we need to be doing right now, you know, which, like, whatever they're actually doing with this limestone. And it just occurred to me, freaking Blackwell wouldn't pay for that. So they're probably just doing whatever, like, the minimum that you can do for safety reasons.
Yes.
Yeah. No, Blackburn, yeah, Blackwell, I keep wanting to call him Blackburn. Blackwell is, yeah, not paying for a slurry. No. Okay. Well, there we go.
There you
plot go. Plot hole fixed. Plot hole filled. And so Elliot is talking to the kid and he asks him how old he is because he looks really young. And he definitely hesitates for too long before he says he's 18.
Now, somebody mentioned that as a possible inconsistency, and I was like, no, honey, that kid is lying.
Yeah. Everyone knows he's lying because they knew his dad, and we know that 2 years ago he was having his 14th birthday party, but also they know that he needs to pay the mortgage, so yeah. I'm sure they all fibbed for him, and he needs to help his mom and his sister, because it was his dad that we met earlier. Oh, it's so sad. And Elliot, meanwhile, plants a little gadget that Hardison came up with that'll boost the signal down to the mine so they can actually use the earpieces because, you know, it's hard to get the signal down there. Which is just a great, like, filling a plot hole before it needs to be filled, and it comes in handy later. And he puts it into this old intercom speaker. So once it's in place, Hardison and Sophie ask to go into Section C of the mine, and Hardison uses a tool that looks like a speed gun. Clark is like, that doesn't look like a dust testing kit, and Hardison gets to be, like, obnoxious to him. And then he and Sophie, like, start whispering to each other, like, oh, are you sure? Yeah. Oh, I think that's it. And they're really, really kind of pleased, which makes Clark suspicious. And then we have Parker, who is doing her best little Southern Belle accent. And she's been hard at work for Pierre. She says she set up some social media accounts for her. She set up a new pack called Tomorrow's Women to consolidate all of their online donations. And they've already made $436. And she's praised for being a fast worker.
And then they show the montage.
The montage is so good. We're like, yes, she is a fast worker. She's like putting bugs everywhere. She's like downloading stuff from this lady's computer. She smells her phone.
She's so and earlier, as the woman walks off, she makes this face at her back, like, that amused me. And then there's a point where she, like, reaches out to touch her hair. Yes.
And then Hardison says something to her earpiece. She's like, oh, yeah, sorry. So creepy. So
floofy.
What?
It is floofy.
Yeah, it's very floofy. So Clark tells Blackwell that Sophie and Hardison are you know, kind of suspicious and they did some weird readings. And Blackwell is also suspicious that these inspectors came right before someone came in to try to buy the mine out from under him. And he's like, do you know where they're staying? And Clark says, no, but they asked for a recommendation for where to eat, and I sent them down to Carver's. So Blackwell follows them there, and Nate and Sophie have this really obvious meetup of like, oh, hey, how did it go? It was nice doing business with you, Mr. Gibson.
Super wink, obvious. Wink, uh-huh. Nudge, nudge.
And Sophie has an American accent when she's acting as the inspector, and then she switches back to a British one. She's like another, like, oh my gosh, she's not who she said she was. The Carver Cafe, for fans of the Twilight series, is where Bella and her dad, Charlie, eat lunch in Twilight.
I saw that as well, and I was like, carry me home, West Virginia. Did not see that one coming.
It's great. So Blackwell confronts Sophie, who officially drops her American accent, and tells them that they've been hired to look for Colton, which is a real mineral used in microchip processors for phones and video games and DVD players and things like that. Usually it's mined in Central African countries where it has caused a lot of instability, mm-hmm. Most notably in the Democratic Republic of Congo. Let's bring that to West Virginia. Though I'd probably be handled a little differently here. I don't know.
Would it?
No, you're right. You're right. Using her process that she says her company has, Gibson could mine all the coltan right from out from under Blackwell, because he owns the areas
around it,
the land around it. And Blackwell is not about to let that happen. So he leaves and he's on his way to call Pierce. And Parker makes sure that Pierce can find the form that Bob Gibson has submitted for mineral rights. And he wants her to bury this form so he can't actually get through all the bureaucracy to do this. And she's like, well, I can hide it, but only for so long, because he probably also filed it with some other office. And so Blackwell has to move fast. He calls Sophie and says, you know, I want to buy the process from you before Gibson can. But first he wants a demonstration. So they go back down to the mine and they have the gun out again, but he's like, oh no, I'm smart. I'm not going to fall for some fancy, you know.
Yeah, I'm going to put it in a vial.
Yeah, I'm going to do some scrapings of my own. And he does a little chemical test and it comes out positive for coltan, but that's because Elliot and Corey earlier in the mine were dusting the rocks with coltan laced limestone.
As one does.
Yeah, I mean, like you have to do. He's pretty stoked about finding all this coltan in his mine. And then he like goes on this like monologue of evil.
Oh my gosh.
Evil speech of evil.
I'll be able to lay off these hillbillies.
Oh my God. He's like, used to be able to make a buck.
Unions and having to pay people. I'm like, yeah.
They want all the work. Yeah, it's sick. And Sophie is a seasoned grifter, and she and Hardison both look like they're trying not to throw up in their mouths, which is awful. So, you know, he's like, okay, we're going to go ahead with this. And she says, all right, but let's talk numbers. And Nate is going through all of his bank records, and he knows that he's only got $100,000 liquid that he can pay for himself, but then he has $500,000 in the pack. So she's like, oh, we need $600,000 and we want it in one payment. And we want it tomorrow, because that's when Mr. Gibson would pay us.
And that's why she's a grifter and I'm not, because she can say a number that big and not even change her facial expression.
Yeah, she's like, that's perfectly reasonable for what I'm offering you. And I'd be like, $600,000? Could you do that?
Exactly.
It's not too much trouble. And Blackwell says, you know, if they come to this political fundraiser for the Attorney General tomorrow, he'll have a check for them. And so Nate's like, okay, let's all go get into position. Everybody like, go get ready for tomorrow. And Elliot's like, oh, I don't want to leave these guys one man down.
Yeah.
Not here. And I'm like, Elliot, you were such a man of the people.
He's been giving career advice to young Corey. And he's not going to leave the job early, because then somebody'd have to pick up his slack.
It's so good.
Oh, Elliot.
And I love Nate's like, fine, say and play. and he does. He connects with Corey over his lunchbox, and he like has a little inside joke with him now. And then he his advice is to tell him to learn how to use the scoop. Like the machinery is the future. Mm-hmm. It's safer and it makes more money. And if he were smart, he would work, learn how to use and fix the machinery. Which is just, it's really nice. It's a really nice thing to do.
And smart. Good advice too.
Exactly. So Parker shows Pierce her new numbers after like 12 hours. And they're significantly higher than they were before. And poor Hardison was just like, earlier.
You didn't make them higher. You didn't say how high.
I didn't know what significantly higher was. And earlier with the limestone, he's like, it's going to look different. I laced it with coltan. Like, Hardison is doing 80 things. He can't be expected to get everything 100% right.
That's one of the things I love about Hardison. I always remember that one episode where he made the book and aged it and everything. I'm like, Hardison, I feel you with your detail-oriented
He's so perfect. I love it so much. So it, you know, Nate says it's fine. We just want her to be confident enough in her campaign that she's not going to question Blackwell's need for all of these campaign funds that he needs to take out of the pack. But I love their interactions, by the way. And we haven't talked about this actress, but she's also in everything.
Like, she's been, quite good.
Yeah, she's been in like one episode of every show ever. And her name is Annie Fitzgerald. But yeah, so she's not confident enough that she is willing to let him take $500,000 from the campaign funds. And she tells him to use the mine, like the money from the mine. And that he's like, well, I could take it out of payroll, but that would bankrupt the mine.
And she kind of looks at him like, exactly.
She's like, would that be a bad thing? And she's kind of turned on by it. Like,
and it was ew. I'm like, you people are wrong.
So wrong. And like, I'm not here to kink shame, but that's wrong.
I will kink shame if you get off on hurting other people. That's where I draw the line.
That's true. No, I agree. Yeah, and as we said earlier, like if this mine goes down, the town will suffer. So Nate says
the one that realizes it. He's like, they're not just going to shut it down; they're going to blow it up.
Yeah, because he's seen this. I love that, like bringing back his knowledge from being his the insurance guy.
Yeah.
That, you know, he's seen this a lot before, and he knows that his mine is worth more ruined than not. And since it's basically a bomb already, it won't be hard to start another explosion. So to save everything, they have to convince Blackwell that Sophie is a lying, greedy bitch. And her face is just like, oh, okay.
When he says, I might have taken offense to that, but okay, Sophie.
Well, I don't, like, who, would you give a shit if a person like Blackwell thought you were a lying, greedy bitch?
No.
I mean, no. I might, because that might make him like me more.
Oh, that's true. That seems to be something he likes.
But not if it's screwing him over, like, not at his own expense. So yeah. She's safe. So Nate has to get Blackwell down to the mine. Because if he's inside the mine, if Blackwell's inside the mine, he won't blow it. And that will give Elliot enough time to locate the bomb. Hardison is like, okay, you have fun. I'm going to stay in the van as far away from the mine as possible. Good luck.
Proving once again that Hardison is possibly actually the smartest of the bunch.
100%. And he gives Elliot a handshake hug for morale.
Which is a throwback to the last episode we did.
and Elliot, like, he's like angry about it, but then he goes, and he like smiles and comes at him. He's so weird. So, but then that made me wonder, later in the series, Elliot and Hardison have like their own personal handshake. And I'm like, when did we see that handshake for the first time?
I don't know. I'm sure we're going to come across it.
So yeah, I'm definitely going to keep an eye out for it. Cause at this point, Elliot is like not okay with the bro, like handshake hug thing. He's like, ugh, don't touch me.
He's still not okay with it, but.
He's getting there.
We're getting there.
He's getting there. That's what we call growth. And it's beautiful. So Blackwell goes running out of the fundraiser, trying to call his, site manager Clark to tell him not to set off the bomb yet, so he can go see Nate in the mine. And then Parker and Sophie are at the fundraiser, and they have to freak out Pierce. I Parker, have to
so
say,
ghosts.
Ghosts.
So many ghosts.
I have to be honest. I hate Sophie's dress.
I was like, what is up with that? It was so shapeless.
It's shapeless. It's like that silk that wrinkles the second you sit down. So it already has some wrinkles in it. And I'm like, I know that a costume person steamed this while it was on you and it's still showing wrinkles. It's not good. I don't like it.
Especially next to Parker's day to night Barbie wear that she's been all of her nice little suits and
the red and white.
Yeah.
She's very coded. Like that color combination is very like, I'm a Republican. Sorry for the horrible accent.
Come to think of it, Pierce wears a lot of red too.
She does. Yeah. So I think it's definitely to kind of signal to Pierce that they're on the same wavelength. But yeah, so like you were saying, they need to spook Pierce.
So oh my gosh. So that's this she'll is move. The best one.
So she'll move. So she'll move the money out of the pack. And Parker says, ghosts? No. So then she's going through her notes and she's like bringing up all these things that are completely normal. Oh, like
she's like, okay, she puts her blue pins and her black pins in the same cup together.
Misses them up.
She doesn't want to talk to her mother.
Yes, she wants to. Like,
no, so he's like, that's not really what I'm looking for.
She drinks her coffee with one cream and six sugars.
Six sugars.
Could we use that?
I'm surprised she still has teeth.
Oh my gosh, yes.
and then finally you get the, well, she and Blackwell worked out.
Yeah, on Thursday. And and Sophie's like eyes like completely light up. And she's like, what? And so they like call Hardison and they're like, play us the audio from Thursday. And she knows exactly the time.
Exactly. Like 3:16 to 4, whatever.
Yeah, to like 4:25 or something. And it's obviously not working out. It's them. He's like, sex, Parker. They're knocking boots.
And for some reason, knocking boots is one of the expressions that always makes me laugh. So yes.
I love it. And Parker's like, oh, okay. Sure. Can we use that?
Sophie's like so far ahead of you.
Yeah. And she says, like, with that, I can make her do anything I want. Oh, and I love when Sophie, like, she's like, I have all the power now. Get ready, bitches. Yes. I'm coming. So Hardison's like, okay, well, this was really fun and traumatizing, but I have to go back to helping Elliot find the bomb. So we see Elliot replace an oxygen marker, and then he like very cryptically writes an X on a support beam with a piece of chalk as he's complaining to Hardison, because Hardison's like, you know, I can see heat signatures, but it's like playing Frogger. It's really old school. And he's like, well, you can keep playing video games and I'm going to look for a bomb. Because there are several times in this episode. And I wonder, I mean, it's always a thing with Elliot, but I wonder if it's because it has to do with something that's not super high tech, like coal mining. And he like feels really, and like he feels this connection to these people who like work on the land. And then Hardison's like spouting all this like technical mumbo jumbo.
Yes.
He's like even more like, I don't freaking care. I'm going underground. I don't want to hear this.
There's serious things going on here. There's a bomb. There's methane.
Yeah, I don't want to hear the jingo. The jingo? The lingo. I don't want to hear the lingo.
At this point, I have a note that says, apparently bastard is the word of the episode.
Yeah. A couple times. Speaking of bastards, Sophie meets up with Pierce at the fundraiser and starts gushing about how grateful she is about her contribution to the mine, saying that the money that Danny got them from the pack, you know, is going to be so helpful, and then insinuating that she's sleeping with Blackwell.
Oh yeah, she's like he told me that last, or was it this morning?
And I love, she's like, oh, Danny said, and she's like, Danny, do you mean Mr. Blackwell? She's like, sure. And Pierce is pissed because she pulls up the account on her phone and she sees that there's a transfer of $500,000 pending from the pack. And down in the mine, Nate proves to Blackwell that the scraping that he took earlier was just something that was put on the surface. And if you scrape a little more, then it does not come out positive for Colton. And he's upset that Sophie and Hardison salted his mine.
Mm.
Yeah. And Hardison finds out where the bomb is hidden. But while Elliot's on his way there, he sees Corey's lunchbox and realizes that he's in the mine somewhere, which means he's in danger. And then things get real. It's exciting and scary for a little bit. The area where Blackwell and Nate are explodes suddenly. And they are kind of knocked out for a second. They come to, Nate's earpiece is offline, which causes everyone to kind of freak out. And Sophie and Parker have to head to the mine ASAP, but Pierce stops Sophie before she can go and tells her she's not going to let her leave. She's called the cops on her for like 80 different things, impersonating a federal
including officer. Impersonating, yes. And she had this, our women don't take kindly to strangers. I'm like,
to outsiders. You're awful pretty. You're not going to do well in prison. This, okay. And she's like, I'm the attorney general. The police are mine. Okay. So, but I love Parker's just like, oh, Miss Pierce, there's a phone call for you. And she's like, I don't have time for this. And she turns around and Sophie has pulled up Batman and disappeared.
As she is wont to do. I bet she was wearing a different dress under that dress. That is my theory.
Oh, yeah. She's like, rip it off.
And the next thing you know, she's looking for a blue dress. But no, Sophie's already out the door wearing a spaghetti strap. That's my theory.
Yes. I mean, we do see her in the blue dress at the whatever.
Sure. Yeah. Plot
hole. She did a second one.
In my mind.
Yeah. So Elliot finds Corey down the mine. He's been working on the scoop because, you know, that's what he said. And Elliot's like angry, but he's like, hey, that's really smart. That was a good thing to do, but not right now. We got to get out of here. So they try to get out, but they run into Clark, who immediately is like, oh, I got to fight you because you're in here.
And Elliot's like, okay.
Elliot's like, fine. It's been a while. I'm itching. And he tells, you know, Corey to get out of there. And he like drops his utility belt. Not a utility belt. His belt and his helmet. And just the way that he drops the belt is so good. He just like undoes it and just like lets it fall to the floor. Like he doesn't take it off and hang it up somewhere. So dramatic. And then they fight, speaking of dramatic, with pickaxes.
Yes.
That quintessential tool of the miner, the pickaxe. Like,
who even does this?
Men. am I wrong?
No. That's why I laughed, because it's true.
And the actor who plays Clark is actually the guy doing the fighting. So he and Christian Kane were fighting instead of stunt doubles. I don't know. Okay, that's the thing you mentioned in my commentary, which is pretty cool. Back in the area where Nate and Blackwell have been closed off into in Section C of the mine, the oxygen meter says they've only got 2 hours of oxygen left. And Blackwell's like, the two of us only have 2 hours. And you're like, oh, man.
I'm like, do you need a mustache to twirl? I mean, seriously, dude.
Yeah.
Mm. I'm like, Nate, why are you turning your back on this man?
Right? No. So Elliot's axe gets stuck in the wall of the mine, and then he's fighting with just the handle of it. And then Nate is fiddling around with the intercom and saying, well, we could just, you know, call someone on the intercom. They could come save us. And Blackwell starts talking about the safety measures that he did not take when he was
including the intercom that does not work.
Yeah, and how all the money went to the attorney general and, you know, what that has done for him. And then when Nate turns around, he beams him with a beam, knocking Nate out, which is awesome. Not really. It's horrible. It's terrifying.
Well, yeah.
So Elliot takes out Clark, then he comes and saves Blackwell. He like moves some rocks and gets him out. And as
another point where I'm like, I would never survive as a member of the Leverage team, because Elliot actually remembered to say, this is Eric. I would never remember my name.
Right?
Just put it out there right now. Bob Gibson. Eloise Whatchamahama. No, I never remember.
You know what? Blackwell doesn't freaking know who Eric is. Like, that's what occurred to me. Like,
I don't remember if he was there. I don't. Well, like, I don't remember that part. I know Clark was, but
Elliot.
You know, I don't know that he was.
No, and I mean, and even if we'd seen a scene where Blackwell had, you know, officially met Elliot's character, there's no way Blackwell, as a character, would remember one miner's name.
No, so he cares, like, not.
What's the point in you saying your name's Eric? But he gets them out, and as Blackwell exits the mine, the police are there, and they take him into custody, and they start cuffing him. And he's like, what's happening? It was Bob Gibson. He blew up the mine. It was him. And they're like, oh, what bomb? Do you mean this one in your pocket?
And you're like, good job, Elliot.
Nice. So we get another flashback. So many educational flashbacks in this episode.
So many.
To the bomb, when Elliot finds it, it's a very easy bomb to defuse. There's just a button.
That was so funny. Because he says to Hardison, boom.
That's not cool. It's not cool. And so then we find out that the explosion that Nate and Blackwell experience was of Hardison's making. It was a micro detonator that Hardison cooked up over the weekend. Ground pound and dust spray and a modified oxygen meter. And he's like, yeah, I did do that over the weekend. he must have so much energy. And it's all then we
it's the orange soda.
It's all the orange soda.
I need some of that to finish this book.
So they put Blackwell into the cruiser, and Pierce is already in there, and she's handcuffed as well, and she's pissed. And we find out that when Nate was messing with the intercom, he fixed the transmitter that was inside the intercom and thus broadcast the entire confession of Blackwell to the police. We're standing outside waiting for him. And Pierce, I love, she still thinks she's been cheated by Blackwell. And so she's like yelling at him, and he's like, what can you do to save us? She's like, I'm not saving you, you two-timing bastard.
Yep. And then there were, I mean, it was the word of the episode.
Exactly. They pulled that word a day calendar
I mean, she's not wrong.
Yeah. No, but not for the reason she thinks. And then as they drive by and the team's all standing there doing their like smug look, she sees Parker with the team. And we get another flashback to Parker reminding her about the other pack that she started, Tomorrow's Women, and we see that she transferred the full amount into that pack, and which that means they can also nail her for misuse of
campaign funds.
And Parker's like, well, yeah, I mean, Sophie told me how to do it, because, you know, Nate praises her a little, and she's like, well, yeah, I nailed it. I'm a grifter. And Nate's like, you know, you can't keep the money, right?
And she kind of like, kind of gives him this like, wait, what?
Don't rain on my parade.
She'd already spin it in her mind.
Exactly.
Probably buy him pinatas. I mean,
the new rigging I'm going to get. Oh. And then I love, she like immediately goes into Lucille 2.0 and like pulls out a pillow and a blanket and lays down to take a nap in her like tight little dress on this hard floor. And she's like, stealing souls is exhausting.
Hardison's flipping through the notes. You aren't taking notes on us, are you? She does not answer.
Well, she does. She goes, do you know you touch your chin every 5 minutes? And he's like, touching his chin. He's like, oh. And it's like, as we said before, Parker doesn't need to write this stuff down. She's got the memory for it. And she's so detail-oriented that she's like, she's got it on all of them. And now she kind of knows how to use it, which is dangerous. Corey walks up to Elliot, and he's like, who are you really? And he tells him that he's friends with Troy, and he came to make the mine safe. It's beautiful. And Corey gets a little emotional about it, and he hugs Elliot. And, like, this is the second time Elliot's been hugged in this episode, and he's like, oh, okay.
But yeah. then he pats the back.
He does. What? He melts a little. Oh, that little tiny boy. And then we see Troy comes into the office, and Nate's like, "Welcome to your new office." And they've put Troy in charge of the mine. And so he's going to be in charge of the safety. And they are able to give him all of the money from the pack, the fake pack, that was originally from the safety commission. And I love Elliot's like, "Hey, watch out for Corey." As if this man has not been doing that for 2 years.
I know.
He's like, "You know he's the son of my dead best friend, right?" I was like,
well, that was probably the only moment where I was like, "Elliot, that might be a bit presumptuous." But Elliot had already threatened to beat Corey up if Corey didn't.
That's true. Like, I'm going to come back and kick your ass, Paul Revere. But then he does say, "You should put him on the scoop. He's got a knack for it."
Yes.
Which is great. And then as they, you know, Nate and Elliot, like, walk off, there's some nice, like, bluegrass music playing. And the construction equipment's still moving around.
There's the guys with the water jugs.
It's good. It's really good. Before we do heist lights, I wanted to say, so I said at the beginning, I have like a personal relation to all of like this coal mining and stuff. So my great and great great grandfather both mined coal in Scranton, Pennsylvania, and my great great grandfather actually died in a mine accident. And my mom was like looking for the article. I can't find it. We were only able to find his obituary, but he was in a mining accident, and they got him out of the mine, and they kept him artificially alive. So this was before, you know, there were respirators and things like that. But they realized that they could, like, raise his arm up and down, and it would simulate, like, the pumping of the heart. Like, it would artificially do that. And so his shift buddies, like, all of the men from the mine, took turns. Like, when they were off shift of the mine, they would be at the house, like, pumping his arm up and down to keep him alive. And they did it for, like, 72 hours. Just, like, someone there continuously doing this to keep him alive until they realized he wasn't going to come back out of whatever he was in, and they had to let him die.
But, what? Brothers.
Yes. So it was real. I mean, have you ever seen Justified?
I don't know that I have.
There's, like, a recurring... Corey was in the last episode, and we both love that show. There's a recurring theme in that where the main character is a marshal, a U.S. marshal, and then the main bad guy, they know each other. And so, like, through the whole series, they're like, it's like cat and mouse trying to catch the bad guy. And they have, like, this recurring refrain of, "Well, we dug coal together." So they have, like, this unbreakable bond. So even though they're on opposite sides of the law, they have this weird kinship. And they say it, it's like in the first episode, it's in the very last episode, "We dug coal together." And it's, like, chilling, and you're like, oh God, what the hell must it be like down there to, like, forge that unbreakable bond? So yeah, Scranton, Pennsylvania. You can apparently go tour the coal mines. And I have no interest in doing that. We went back for a family memorial last summer or the summer before. And some of my cousins we were driving around with were like, "Yeah, the last time we were here, we went on the tour." And it is claustrophobic because you're in the little carts.
Yeah, like, no.
No, thank you.
No.
I don't want to be in an elevator for too long.
Exactly. I think I'll pass on that particular tour.
Yeah. But it would definitely give you, I mean, maybe like things like that are important to kind of see how things used to be.
Oh, I think so. I think it's important. I say no, but I probably would if it were a field trip or something.
Yeah.
I'd be right there.
Small Sally. But yeah. Well, do you have a heist light?
Okay. I saw this one.
Because I know you do.
For once in my life, I got you. Yeah. All right. So, not long ago, in fact, The story was just updated today. There is a place called Avion and Company Jewelers, A-V-I-A-N-N-E, so I'm probably mispronouncing it. It's in New York, and it's a jewelry store that's very popular with rappers and other celebrities. And the thieves forced four employees into a back room and stole all kinds of diamonds. Nobody was hurt. Nobody knows how many diamonds there were. But I will tell you this. One of the dudes was wearing a cowboy hat. And I just, I'm like, that's, you know, if you're going to commit a heist, if you're going to steal some diamonds, so it wasn't very complicated, but.
It would shield your head, your face from.
It actually did. Like, they have surveillance, but of the guy who's wearing the cowboy hat, you really can't see his face very well. Anyway.
Why don't they know how many diamonds were taken? Why don't they know how many diamonds were taken? Did they not have an
inventory? Or I don't know. Maybe they just didn't tell. They didn't. The jewelry company did not say.
Okay, they just didn't want to disclose that.
But I mean, they put the employers, they tied them up with zip ties and duct tape. At least two of the men were holding handguns.
I thought you were just going to say holding hands. I was like, wow, this is
They were holding hands. They stopped to sing Kumbaya.
It was like a Bonnie and Clyde situation.
Ah, there we go. Police have not said how much was stolen.
Okay.
But the men did leave a duffel bags full of jewelry.
Wow. Duffel bags.
Duffel bags.
That's a lot. Wow. Okay. Diamond heists in New York. My heist flight takes us to the other side of the country.
Most excellent.
I know. I was like, we're just traveling all over. The name of the con in this episode was the Skagway Shuffle, and the Skagway Shuffle refers to an actual con artist whose name was Soapy Smith. And he, yes, he was just your run-of-the-mill confidence artist and old-fashioned crook. And it says, there were a lot of, so this is an article from this is an article from Alaska Public Radio. It says, there were a lot of dangers faced by the people flooding the American West in the late 19th century. And at least as dangerous as inclement weather, tuberculosis, or a stray bullet was the good old-fashioned crook. The story of Soapy Smith is a story of a swindler, and a pretty good one, too. So he started out, and I love this. Where did he start? He started in Denver in 1879, where he put up shop on the street, and he had a shell game. So whenever I think of shell game, I think of, like, three-card Monty. But his shell game was completely different. And I don't think it's completely bad, because, so he... had a suitcase, and he would fill it with bars of soap wrapped in paper. And the deal was you would buy a bar of soap for $5 with a chance that under the paper there was also money. So like a 10 or a 20 or maybe a $50 bill. There was never any money under them.
Of course there wasn't.
But I'm like, but you still got soap. And it was 1879 and you needed soap.
Needed it.
So I think that Soapy, that's where he gets his name, you know, he was really doing a service for the, you know, the city of Denver.
Really? I mean, it's a public service grift.
Yes. And speaking of public service, from that, he naturally went into politics for a little bit.
That seems fair.
He helped rig voting in local elections. I mean, he ran protection rackets, though he remained in the class of nonviolent gentleman criminals. But then after a trial... a trial after elections in 1892, they drove him out of town, out of Denver for a while. So he bounced around a little bit. He went to Texas. He went to then he would go back to St. Louis to visit his wife and kids frequently. And then he goes to Alaska. So he ships out there for a while, and then he comes back, and there's like a whole year. This is the account of this historian who she wrote a book about him. And talking. So he like went to Juneau and he tried to do his soap thing again, but he was arrested. And even though it was under a fake name, like nobody else is running this soap pipe, so you knew it was him. So he like had a $25 fine, and so he's like, I'm not gonna hang out in Juneau anymore. So he decides that he's going to go elsewhere. So he goes to Hope, Alaska, near where there's like the gold rush is happening. And he ends up in Skagway, Alaska, thus the Skagway Shuffle. He gets there in 1898 and he builds a saloon. And I think there's still like a diner called the Soapy Smith Diner or something. And it says he was there from the get-go. I don't think Soapy had any intention of going to the Klondike itself. So I guess it's like the last place you stop before you go off on your gold rush. Winter. And so he, it's the center of gold rush commerce, but it's also still small enough that it doesn't have any legal oversight really. And so there's no way he's going to get in trouble with from Juno or anything. So he gets a full crew and he has several different schemes set up to fleece people, including one that relied on a phony telegraph line. So there was no telegraph line in Skagway out to the Klondike, but he would let people send telegrams and they would get like to their loved ones to see how they were. And then they would get telegrams back from their loved ones just saying, "Can you send money?" And then he would just take the money from them.
This is like those people that write love letters and...
Yes! So, I love this, but he says, where is it? Soapy's response to the criticism was that he was saving people. If you were so stupid as to be caught by these tricks, he was saving you from certain death in the Klondike. But then people kept getting, like, angry at him. And by the summer of 1898, it says people have suggested that he kind of knew that the game was up, so he got really drunk, which was apparently a bad idea for him because he tended to be really lacking in common sense when he got drunk. And he tried to go to a town meeting and he brought his shotgun. And Frank Reed, who was one of the guards, they basically shot each other simultaneously. So he died at 38. But from like just Googling this guy, he has like, they like celebrate his death day. Like he's like still a big deal in Alaska.
Is there not much to do there?
There is not much to do in Alaska during certain parts of the year. I've been there. It is beautiful. But I don't know in Skagway if they have a lot.
That's true.
Maybe they have a telegraph now though. But yeah, that's Soapy Smith, who the Skagway Shuffle is named for.
Of the true Skagway Shuffle.
Yeah, I love it. All right. Sally, do you have anything you'd like to plug?
Well, my Christmas book just won the Georgia Author of the Year Award.
Yay!
And the Greater Detroit Romance Writers Bookseller's Best.
Shut up! I didn't see that one. That's amazing.
Yeah, so
starting to check every state off your list.
I am, slowly but surely. Slowly but you know what? They just do not like me in Florida.
Well, I feel like Florida has questionable taste in general.
But I'll just keep trying. Maybe they just didn't like the Christmas book.
Yeah, yeah. And then you have this short story collection that you have a story in?
Yes, Once Upon a Wedding, which is free for Kindle Unlimited, I need to add. Oh, while we're plugging, yeah, my first book, The Happy Hour Choir, is also free on Kindle Unlimited right now.
There you go.
That's new and exciting.
Go get all of Sally's books on Amazon.
Please do.
I mean, some of them you get for free. Pay a couple dollars. Yes. Her daughter just got contacts. They need
yes. It's going to be an adventure.
I love it. And where can people find you on the internet?
You can find me at sallykilpatrick.com. Or more likely, you can find me on Twitter at SuperWriterMom. That's where I spend too much of my time.
I understand, because I am also there a lot of the time, and I'm at Librarian Steve there. I don't have anything to plug, except that I just started listening to a new podcast called Lie, Cheat, and Steal, which is about cons. It's great. I just listened to an episode about LuLaRoe and how that's all a big pyramid scheme. It is full of drama of the like Mormon variety. The Mormon pill-popping variety.
I'll be checking that out. There's supposed to be a book about the Tupperware lady, too.
What?
Yeah, there's a book about the Tupperware lady. I'm not sure that that falls under this same kind of pyramid scheme per se, but anyway, you said LuLaRoe and I thought Tupperware.
Yeah. What is that? What's that other word? Not
multi-level media. No.
Yes. No, you've got it. Multi-level model, multi-level merchandising. MLM.
Yes, it's MLM.
Because in the podcast, they joked about MLM, like, also means men loving men.
Like, that's a different pyramid scheme.
The person who they had on to talk about it, like, she has a Facebook group for it where, like, people post things, and she will have people join the group and be like, oh, I came because I thought this was a men loving men Facebook group, but I'm staying for all the drama. This, you know, multi-level marketing.
Ah, yes. Multi-level marketing.
Yeah, this is the one that I just avoided. So it's pretty great. So yeah, lie, cheat, and steal. Sally, the next episode is the Rashomon job. That's a good episode. I don't know who's coming on for that one, but it's because we missed last week, I'm just going to have 2 weeks in a row where an episode will come out so that we don't get off the schedule. So the Rashomon job will be up next week, knock on wood. Yeah. So you won't see us again, but you'll hear us again in 1 week. Talk about the Rashomon job. Thank you for talking with me today, Sally.
Well, thank you for having me.
Yes. Literally anytime. Literally.
I'm going to crash the party then one of these days.
Yes. It's fun having more than one co-host because everybody's talking on top of each other. It's wonderful.
Yeah. The cat's of leverage.
That's right. No. Oh my gosh, that's like a calendar. The cats of leverage, and you just have them doing different heists.
Mm-hmm.
It'd be amazing. Amazing. Okay, so